Welcome to the Muscle Expert Podcast with Ben Pakulski, one of the world's top professional bodybuilders, an expert on human performance and mindset mastery. Ben dives deep to deliver the strategies of the top experts to upgrade your body, mind, muscle, strength, performance, biochemistry, and how to become the upgraded modern man. Join us on BenPakulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Ben Pakulski, Muscle Expert Podcast, and you guys are about to listen to an incredible lady. Dr. Loretta Berning is going to teach us all about the mammal brain and how to interact with the world. So we are all products of our environment. We're all products of our upbringing. All these little neural networks and little neural pathways that are developed from the meaning that we place on our past. And learning to live your greatest life in the future means starting to pay attention to your past and then how to manipulate it. And Dr. Berning gives us some really nice insights in how to start the process to start changing your life and changing your brain so you can be happy, you can be confident, you can live your greatest life. And she also talks about some really interesting insights into competition and why it's so essential to us as mammals to need competition. You're going to absolutely love this episode. Enjoy.
Hey guys, I interrupt the podcast to bring you a message from our sponsor, ATP Labs. And our feature product of the week is Estro Control, which has quickly become one of our best selling products, both to men and women. Even though it looks pink and you may think it's a predominantly female product, I actually recommend it to a lot of my male clients. We're exposed to so many environmental estrogens, so many xenoestrogens in our drinking water, in plastic bottles, and anything we eat that's plastic can expose our body to potentially dangerous xenoestrogens. And Estrogen Control is a proven formula to help our body start to eliminate these xenoestrogens. So another way you can do it is with infrared saunas, but I recommend adding Estro Control for anybody who's noticing potentially decreased testosterone ratios, potentially accumulated additional fat around your bottom and your lower half and your thighs. That can often be indicative of elevated estrogen. So if you're someone who experiences some of those symptoms, head over to ATP Lab right now. Check that out. Estro Control is the product. And because you're cool and because I love you, use the code BEN10 and get 10% off. And if you sign up for their VIP newsletter, you will also get free shipping. So that's super cool. 10% and free shipping. Sign up for the newsletter. Back to the episode. Enjoy.
You throw a lot of stuff on your website. So the website is the Inner Mammal Institute. And the website... .org. And throughout the website, you talk a lot about serotonin, you talk a lot about dopamine, you talk about a lot about oxytocin and how those are influencing people. And I think it'd be a great place to start to give people an idea of what those are. And because some people have a vague idea, but I think it's also misunderstood and misinterpreted in a lot of ways. And certainly the level of knowledge is relatively low in the area. So if you wouldn't mind just walking us through how, so well you articulated on the website. It's a pretty clear, if anybody wants a great definition, I'll link to it in the show notes so you can check it out on that website. So if you could help us with that.
Yes, sure. So dopamine is something we hear a lot about today, especially in the context of addiction. Once again, we were talking before about my comfort with academic psychology because addiction is now presented in a way that is disempowering, that a person is like a victim of addiction, which I don't think is very helpful in getting people to build new patterns, which is the only solution. So dopamine is the chemical that in today's world makes you feel excited that you're about to get a reward. Now, most people don't acknowledge that because it's like, oh, well, that's greedy to care about rewards. But in the state of nature, you had no steady food supply. You had to constantly look for food. So imagine you're looking around the world. Oh, there's something. But you have to make careful decisions because if you run after, let's say you're a lion and you run after a gazelle that you can't catch, you'll soon run out of energy and starve to death. So you have to make careful decisions about which reward to go after. And that's what we're always deciding. And when you see something and you say, I can get that, whatever that is, that's what releases the dopamine. And then you take the first step, it releases your energy. And each time you see yourself getting a step closer, that releases more dopamine. Once you get what you want, forget it. No more dopamine. That's the problem. And then it's metabolized. You feel good for a few minutes. And then you can see like a monkey is digesting a big meal. And then its belly is empty and it needs more dopamine to motivate it to look for more food. And that's how our brain was designed to work. So it doesn't pay to blame society. This is how who we are.
So moving on to serotonin, giving our listeners a little bit better understanding of serotonin.
So my first book was about this. It's called iMammal, How to Make Peace with the Animal Urge for Social Power.
Yes.
And in the description of the book, I give some synonyms that will help. Ego, pride, assertiveness, self-confidence, self-esteem, feeling special, feeling important, one up. So you can see that this is going on every minute among everybody. But when other people do it, it bugs you. But when you do it, you feel like you're only trying to survive. And I really recommend all these nature videos where they show you how that's happening among animals to just be less, like not be so sensitive about it and to just say that natural selection built a brain that seeks the one-up position because it promotes your genes. And you can also see how pushing your kids into the one-up position becomes part of this mammalian impulse.
I love it. One of my favorite things that you spoke about on the site was cortisol. And your body's emergency alarm triggered by pain, anticipation of pain. Tell me about that.
Okay, so your brain is designed to protect you from having to touch a hot stove twice. So imagine, you know, you were a kid and you grew up around fire. You never needed to touch it more than once because pain is a huge surge of cortisol that paves a pathway that starts turning on more cortisol the next time you see something different. The next time you see something similar.
Similar, yeah.
Similar. So, in the safe-ish world we have today, which is hard for people to believe, we don't have a lot of pain. So social pain is what preoccupies us. So what is social pain? So in the animal world, you needed a group for safety from predators. And that's the oxytocin feeling. We could talk about that next. Mm-hmm. So if I'm separated from the group, then I'm the one that's going to be eaten by a predator. So the brain evolved to motivate you to avoid anything that looks unsafe by turning on the bad feeling. And if you don't risk being eaten by a predator, then being cast out of the group increases the risk. And so that's why, you know, if somebody raises one eyebrow at you and you say, they don't like me, they're judging me, you know, your cortisol turns on and you get this predator threat feeling from minutia, and you're doing that to yourself, and you can stop because it was a learned pattern and you can learn a new pattern.
How do we learn that? So, you know, most people, obviously you talked about our childhood. We're probably framing it on something that's happened in our childhood, on some meaning we've placed on an event in our childhood, but how do we start the process of overcoming that?
So it's good to imagine that when you're a child, so we're all born with billions of neurons, but no connections between them. So those connections build very easily when you're young, and any connections you build get myelinated, which means, and you probably know in your field, whatever field you're in, somebody who learns when they're young builds myelinated pathways that are super highways in your brain where electricity, it's like an insulated wire is much more efficient than an uninsulated wire.
Right.
Once you get past puberty, your myelin is only down to replacement level. So you don't build new super highways in your brain. So what it takes is repetition. And this is not what anybody wants to hear, but it would be, for example, that you take that thing that scares you. Like, let's say going to somebody who you feel judged by and saying, I have a good idea. And then maybe you think, oh, you're getting a bad reaction from them. But if you do that every day and you say to yourself, they're not dissing me, they're just repeating their old pathways, and I'm perfectly safe whether I get their approval or not. I can have a full life by taking steps toward meeting my needs, regardless of them. And not saying that with anger, but saying that with serotonin, with confidence in your own skills. So if you do that every day for 45 days, you'll build a new pathway, but you're not going to love doing it.
I love that. And I was going to bring that up. As you said, skill acquisition takes 45 days. Now, is that the type of thing where it's, you know, getting into the actual neurochemistry of it? Is that something that just has to be the cognitive thought process needs to be congruent for 45 days, or does there need to be some type of physical action taken? Like walking me down the path of the actual neurochemical process to reform these myelin pathways, myelinated pathways. Is it just as simple as like, I need to have the same mindset?
Yes. First, when I say, I don't want to say reform because they never formed in the first place. Right. And I just really want to emphasize that it's not like anything's wrong with you. And that idea is now being peddled that something is wrong with you because that's how they can charge it to your medical insurance.
Right, right.
But nothing is wrong with you. Don't believe that there are other people who have these perfect brains and life comes easy to them. It's not easy for anybody. We're all in the same. So how do you do it? It helps to think, as you probably have heard, that every neuron has a space between the neurons around it. Yep. And you can only have a new thought if you can get electricity down that neuron and jump to the next one. So the way I think about it, it's like you have a jungle of neurons, and imagine if you're actually in a jungle and there is one paved road through the Amazon, but that paved road goes to a disgusting city and you want to go to some beautiful place. So you have to carve a new trail through the jungle. And that is so hard. It takes so much labor to just go one step. And once you carve a new trail and you go back there the next day, then it's overgrown and all your work was for nothing. But if you go, if you travel the exact same trail every day, then a pathway will establish. But it's that same trail, which is why I suggest, yeah, carefully design that one positive new thought or behavior. And as you said, if you combine a thought and an action, maybe it'll help you. But define it carefully so that you can repeat it every day to build that pathway. Define it in a positive way. So you can't say, I don't want to smoke, because that's a negative and that will just make you think of smoking. Right. So think of, what do I want to do in that moment when I wanted a cigarette? Is I want to think something positive about myself. Now, it's hard. It's not just gratitude. It's thinking something positive about yourself. Now, you may have a bad feeling when you think of something positive about yourself, because that's the old child circuit. So that you have to go deeper and deeper to try to find what is, you know, how did that start? What was I told? And what would be the alternative? So a common example would be, who do you think you are? You know, what do you think you're so special? So the alternative to that is, it's natural for me to seek steps toward meeting my needs. That's what everyone else is doing. Now, you may have been told that you're not supposed to help yourself. You're supposed to help others. Again, that's like another whole book. But the idea is, you can help others, but you have to help yourself first. And helping others doesn't always help, because they are responsible for their choices and you can't control their brain. So you're respecting them for their brain power, and you deserve that respect for your brain power.
Now, is this, you know, looking at this neurochemically, is this primarily serotonin? Is this acetylcholine involved? And is it as simple as just, I want to think about this and create it, associating it with one of my, something that feels good about me? Or is there deeper levels? Is it like, you know, some people say you need some type of incantation, you need some type of articulation that allows you to trigger it? Because I'm going to guess a lot of people are going to have a hard time carving time in their day to make 45 days happen in a row. What is your recommendation as far as like actually adhering to that 45-day process?
Okay. I recognize all of those other strategies that you mentioned, and if they're already working for someone, great. So what I'm thinking is 3 minutes a day. Design a practice that you could do in 1 minute and repeat it 3 times a day. Okay. So that would be time everyone could have. However, the reason people don't do it is because you may be triggering upsetting feelings when you do that 1 minute because you're going into that, all that drama. I'll just give you a simple example. If you grew up around a parent who was very unhappy, then it wires you to take on their pain. And then you're like a evil, disloyal person if your parent gave you that message. How dare you have a good life when I'm suffering? Just an example. Sure. So who wants to stir up that during the workday? Who wants to stir up that at the beginning of a workout? Who wants to stir up that when you go home and have a uncomfortable family dinner or something? So nobody wants to stir that up. So one opportunity, one idea is after I do my 1 minute of positive thought, to follow it with something 1 minute that feels good, or 5 minutes that feels good. But when I say something that feels good, I mean that it's not good for you, but you really like it. And that will train your brain to think, anytime I go into this bad feeling, it's going to be followed by a good feeling. It's sort of like the dog hears the bell and expects a steak. So you expect something good to come after your difficult 1 minute, so that you build a positive expectation. Now, you could see why that's why people often grab a candy bar. You know, how can I instantly create a good feeling to disrupt a bad feeling? So I suggest like imagining that you have a pantry full of ways of creating a good feeling that are healthy and that you can go into that pantry and have it filled up in advance.
Wonderful. One of the most interesting things to me when I started reading over your stuff is just what you said a few minutes ago, how to make peace with your inner mammal. We wake up in the morning and we live in this society that's extremely reactive. So many people have a hard time being conscious of anything. How do we begin the process of shifting from this inner mammal brain to our, you know, ultimately our forebrain and our cerebral cortex?
Okay, well, two things. One is we can celebrate how well we're doing so far first, because in most of human history, people did not have the free choice that we have now. They lived in a particular herd. Oh, I didn't do the oxytocin thing. Let me explain that. Herd thinking, herd behavior. So in the animal world, if you leave your herd, you're likely to get killed. So even a lion who's not going to get killed by a predator, but when a lion catches food, that food will be stolen by a gang of hyenas unless the lion sticks with its pack. So virtually all mammals stick with a group, and they would rather be off with greener pasture because there's so much competition within the group, but they can't leave because of predators. Now, this is how human groups have kept you historically, because they tell you, oh, if you leave us, those predators are going to get you. Now, in the modern world, people leave their family, they leave their religion, they leave their hometown. So that's why this terrible partisan polarizing has been created, because everybody has left their little group. So they need this bigger virtual group to get that oxytocin feeling. But unfortunately, the only way they get it is by hating the other group, which is a disaster. And I hate it. And that's why I wrote the political correctness book. However, so the other thing you said is about how can you be in your cortex. We can't have the illusion that our cortex is running the show. We have two brains because we need both. So it's the relationship or the connection between the two of them. And I've written a new book about this. It's coming out next year. It's called Tame Your Anxiety. It's the idea that if you have a horse and rider, the horse is blaming the rider is blaming the horse, but it's really the relationship between them. So how can you do that? So there was a great case history about a man who had a severed connection between his two brains. Mm-hmm. And his cortisol was still very intellectual and analytical, but it never arrived at a decision. Because the only way you can take a step in this world is when a chemical motivates you. It either motivates you to go toward a reward or retreat to avoid harm, but you need your mammal brain to do that. Otherwise, your human cortex will just analyze everything infinitely, and then you'll end up just repeating what you're already doing. So it's how can you create positive feelings about your new step? So define a new step and then create positive feelings about it by linking it to something positive. Like I said, the idea that it's honorable to meet your own needs because that's the job our brain designed to do. As I meet my own needs, I can try to help others too, but you can't have power over others. You have power over yourself. So you have to focus on stepping toward your own needs. And one of your needs is for acceptance and belonging, but you can't control whether other people accept and belong to, you know. So it's accepting that your brain has these needs, and then you get them for a minute and then you lose them and you have to get them again. And that's who we are.
Of the people you get to interact with, what percentage of them would you speculate are conscious of the reality that there is an interaction between this, reactionary mammalian brain and this potentially responsive evolved brain? Like, do most people, in your best assumption, actually know that these interactions go on? Because obviously I think awareness would be necessary before they can start to control it, right?
Yes. Well, so people read my book, Habits of a Happy Brain, Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Dopamine, Serotonin, Oxytocin, yeah. Endorphin. And then they write to me like, wow, I'm so excited. It's like a whole new world. So the first perceiving it and then doing it, you know, it's not always easy to do, but you only need to step toward doing it to start releasing the good feelings, because all it takes is a step closer to trigger the brain's perception that you're on the path to reward. So a simple example would be the common feeling people have is like, everybody ignores me. You know, I raise my hand and nobody listens. And then you just feel like a victim. And then everything you do in life, you see more evidence that you're a victim. So if you have another way, oh, I see what I could do different. And you start stepping toward that, then just the belief that you are creating something new, you start feeling good right away. Okay.
Yeah, I completely understand. I think the disconnect is most people, like you mentioned, just live in that victim mentality. And it's so hard for people to break that vicious cycle of actually just stepping out of it and becoming aware that, hey, you can actually take control of this and you can take responsibility for your actions. I think that may just be the hardest thing for everyone to do.
Yeah, you know, I know what you mean now, because I'm thinking of the people who write to me about my book that liked it. They're totally unrepresentative sample of the world. So the rest of the world will just look at the cover and say, oh, that's ridiculous. That's BS. and that's offensive. How dare you suggest blah, blah, blah. And so I have chosen not to focus my attention on those people, because when I do that, it just upsets me. So that's why I can't answer your question.
That may be the topic of another book, is like, you have this... What I would say is probably 90% of the population of the world, that when they look at a book that says Habits of a Happy Brain, you know, retrain your brain to boost serotonin, dopamine, oxytocin, they won't even stop because they don't think they have the ability to, you know, retrain your brain. And that's step one, right?
Yes. And it's understandable that someone doesn't think they have the ability, because that's not the medical model that is inculcated in our society. So the example I use is, you expect an expert to fix your brain the way they fix your car. So you wouldn't think of fixing your car yourself. You just expect to bring it to the shop. So it's like, oh, I'm unhappy. I'll bring my brain to the shop and I'll have someone fix it. And the idea of that a pill will fix it has been widely accepted.
In your experience, does everyone have the same propensity to levels of these neurotransmitters, or is there... different genetic phenotypic expressions, meaning someone may have more dopamine naturally, someone may have more serotonin or receptors or whatever. And how would that start to play into someone's predisposition to be able to change their brain?
So I understand what you're saying, because this is central to the current cultural and medical model, the idea of individual differences. To me, it's just another one of those, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. I'm this type, you know, and the worst example of that to me is when a mother is told that your baby is this type or that type. Oh, it's not my fault that my baby is doing this or that. It's that type. Right. So if I'm like with my mother's group, oh, they'll be furious if I take responsibility for an interaction with my child rather than saying, oh, it's the culture and it's this type. So personal responsibility is out of style this year. However, you're not going to live forever. I'm not going to live forever. So by the time it's back in style, it could be too late for me. So we all have the power to embrace it, despite the fact that you're not going to get any support for this mental model around you. So let's just say there are, maybe there are different types, but to so much, to a large extent, they're created from early experience.
So which of your books is that in, the concept of personal reality and how to start paying attention to it? Because you're absolutely right. I mean, everyone wants to blame everything outside of themselves, and not even for themselves, but for everyone around them, right? It's, you know, everyone's now blaming Generation X for being lazy and entitled, and all these people who are 20 to 30 years old are just getting, thrown under the bus for being lazy and entitled. I'm like, man, they're just they're a result of their environment, right? Yeah. So which of your books is that in, that one? Which one should be reading?
Oh, well, I wrote a book called How I Escaped Political Correctness, and you can too.
Right. So,
and that's in there. Not just politics, but it's all of the biology of political correctness and some personal experience of how I had a change of thought process on this and what I did to survive in a world where people are quite polarized. And anyone can take steps to do that, but it is, of course, not easy. But then I also, on a more, if you're not ready for that, I wrote a book called The Science of Positivity, Stop Negative Thought Patterns by Changing Your Brain Chemistry. So that's
I'm ready for all of them because they all sound absolutely amazing. One more question that I think is extremely important to address is, how is the evolution of social media influencing our dopamine life?
Well, as you know, that was, well, there's two things. So one is the phone addiction, and the other is the current involvement of social media in political polarizing. So, and then there's also the current, dopamine addiction issue. So all of these issues together, to me, they're all part of this pattern of blaming what's happening in your mind on what's happening in the world. And you have the power of choice. And to say that you don't have the power to restrict your media consumption, it's crazy. So a simple example I use is when people say you can never have a cookie because if you have a cookie, you'll eat the whole box. So then there is the worldview of, well, it's not my fault I ate the whole box. It's the cookie manufacturers that made them too appealing. And then the other people who say, I will never, ever, ever eat a cookie in my whole life. So in between there's like, okay, so what I say is, okay, if they have big cookies, break one in half, wrap half, put it in the freezer. Then the other half, I break that in half and I have half in the morning and half at night. And I have a good life. When anybody can do that. So I don't get these polarized extremes. And then when I try to talk about the way I do it, I might get a lot of disapproval. So then I have to say, okay, you know what? I'm just going to do it and not talk about it. So that's really what a lot of people might need to do.
Well, self-control, right? Like how do we start to exude self-control? Because you talked about how people are, I believe now I may be misquoting on this, but on your website, there's a lot to do with, people effectively trying to do things to influence oxytocin, I guess, to make themselves feel good, right? So if we're, you know, an example being if I'm working out, maybe I'm trying to do something to bring that cortisol level down, and people are just eating to, you know, eliminate these feelings that they have. They're trying to compensate for elevated cortisol. So
what's another way to relieve these feelings? I have to tell you two little slice of life examples that showed me when I realized that everybody else has this same, it's really, the word is shame. It's this feeling of like, I'm not good enough. I'm at risk of being rejected. And that's because we're born, our brain, we're absolutely powerless and vulnerable. We need social support to survive. So we see social support as a matter of life and death. And that's what wires us to see social support as a matter of life and death. Now, I read this book called Playground Politics that I read that you have like the popular kids and the unpopular kids. And this is the worldview that gets wired in because our brains are built at the time that all this is going on. The popular kids, I learned when they go to a group of people and say, can I play? So even the popular kid has to say, can I play? And even the popular kid gets rejected 25% of the time. They get accepted a little more often because they learn strategies of how to join in. But partly it's because they just have the confidence to say, can I play more often? So that was like such a revelation. It's like, oh my God, everybody lives with the same frustration. So maybe I want to say, can I play and tolerate rejection? Or maybe I don't even want to play because I don't want to conform to that game. But either way, I'm making the decisions. I don't have to feel like a victim. So that's one whole like amazing thing that helped me feel better. Another one is the same story, but based on monkeys. So there was a story where monkeys are very rough with each other. And when we see this on like the nature videos that are not the good ones, they say, oh, they're just playing, but they're not playing. They're building skills for conflict in later life. And they're building an awareness of their strength. So what happened is this one monkey, they had to take it out to do a medical procedure. When they put it back in, it was awake, but it wasn't 100%. So it was weak. And what the author said in this book was, the other guys would have killed it. They started beating it up because it was weak. And it said, this was its group, its troop that it had spent its whole life with. And if those researchers didn't pull it out, it would have gotten killed by them just for momentary weakness. It's like, oh my God. It said, this is the brain we've inherited, which is why we're so armored and defensive. Because other people really, when they see weakness, they really do exploit it. And it's not our society's fault. It's been this way forever.
I absolutely love that. So one final thing, you sound like you're probably the most amazing parent. And a lot of our a lot of our listeners are parents. So how do we start integrating this? I'm a father of three. How do I start integrating this thought process and this personal responsibility concept with my children?
So I started doing this research when my baby left for college. And a lot of it was motivated by my guilt of not having done the right thing. So right. I did not do this. Yes. So what was the wrong thing? I rewarded bad behavior, which is a very common impulse. And so my first solution is always to start with the self-acceptance. So the self-acceptance part is that I was beaten when I was young, and it was rather common. I mean, it certainly wasn't a crime, and more people, you know, maybe some people had moved out of that culture, but many still did, and it was sort of accepted. And so today, I think it's rather shunned in most cultures, although there are still some cultures, and then PC people will defend them, but I think it's a disaster. It's not good to beat kids. But how do you then be an authoritative parent without violence? I never learned that because I never had a model for that. So I went to that abdication role because I was working so hard to restrain myself from exploding the way I was modeled for me. When my first child was 7, I read this book called Dare to Discipline. And you won't believe it, but it was the first time in my life that I heard the word discipline having a positive connotation, because it was always, it was like a negative. And so when my oldest was like 7 and my youngest was 2, and, you know, 7 is like the, in my books, you'll see 7 is like the end of your first mile and spurt. So my first child was already like basically formed then. And even then, I didn't have much discipline. So what can you tell parents? So the first thing is there's something called mirror neurons. Mirror neurons is what we activate when we observe another individual getting a reward or suffering pain. So your kids are going to learn more from what you do than what you say, which is what we've always known. And now this is the science side of it. So when your kids see that you are rewarded by a job well done, that's good. And that's what they're going to learn from. But if your kid does a bad job and is nasty, and then you reward them anyway because you can't say no to your kid, they're also going to learn from that. So those are two simple solutions.
It's wonderful. So one more question came to my head that's very applicable to me and my demographic. How relevant is your, you know, here, I'll give you the exact preface. When we exercise and we're taking it to the hardest depths of the, you know, challenging what we've ever done, my articulation is always it's one of your greatest opportunities to find the joy and literally smile. Is there any neurochemical changes that can happen just from kind of telling your brain or telling your face that you're happy? Is that just me making myself feel good?
I know that there has been this research about the Duchenne smile. It's called, yes. Okay. And there's also this thing about laughter yoga. So my personal take on this is not in favor of that, but mine is in favor of laughing. I think laughing triggers endorphin because it triggers movement in deeper abdominal muscles that you don't usually get. And any way you can fit laughter into your life. And how do you do that? So one thing is giving yourself permission to focus on things that you find are funny, even if other people around you don't think they're funny. Okay.
I love it. Loretta, absolutely amazing. So many books. Could you just spell out your website one more time? We're going to link to it in the show notes, but I want to make sure everyone can find you on your website and on social media.
Thanks. It's innermammalinstitute.org. And we have a jillion different resources. I have video, books, lots of blogs. And if you like graphics, have lots of that too.
It's truly an amazing site. You did such a great job of making it simple because there's a lot of information out there around dopamine, serotonin. There's books that I recommend to people, but I've never found a resource that was quite as simple and well articulated as yours. So I'm truly grateful to have connected with Loretta. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the good questions.
All right. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
So I hope you enjoyed this podcast with Dr. Loretta Bruning. And you guys could tell by my enthusiasm that I absolutely love this conversation because so many of us are living this life of desperation and not taking ownership for our life. It's time to start taking complete personal responsibility for everything in our lives. And that is the only way, guys, to start living your greatest life. As Dr. Loretta so eloquently explains, it's all this eloquent dance with all of your neurotransmitters from serotonin, oxytocin, endorphins, dopamine, and learning how to manipulate these things with your environment and with your perception of your environment is going to be the key to living your greatest life. So I know a lot of you out there are either living a life of stress or living a life of reactivity. and you're looking for a greater life, and so are a lot of people around you. So please give Miss Loretta Berning a shout out on social media. Head over to her website, pick up her book to support this cause, because she's doing an awesome job. I literally have read hundreds of books on this topic, and I've never found anybody articulating as well as her. So go back and listen to this podcast again if you think there's something in there that you're going to love. And as always, share it with at least one person. And as always, share it with at least one person that you know will love this, because we are all living a life of overstress, overreactivity, and I want everyone to live their greatest life. Have an awesome day.